States was warned long ago.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
And warned and again. Then warned again, not long after.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
In fact, the U.S. is still warned to this very day. But are you listening?
Are you listening?
What if the American people woke up and understood that the official reasons for going to war are almost always based on lies and promoted by war propaganda in order to serve special interests? What if we as a nation came to realize that the quest for empire eventually destroys all great nations? What if the American people learned the truth? That our foreign policy has nothing to do with national security, that it never changes from one administration to the next.
And this is Republic Theory with Dallas Andrews and Warren Dyson.
And welcome to Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM. I'm Dallas Andrews.
And I'm Warren Dyson.
And we like to talk. We like to talk a whole lot. Welcome to the show. Our focus is going to be none other than the great country of the United States of America, and specifically our Constitution, the great people in this country. However, we will focus extensively on what is wrong with this country. And I'm talking about the kind of thing that that would make the Founding Fathers turn and roll in their grave, if you will. Wouldn't you agree, Warren?
Well, not only turn and spin in their graves is a term I love to use, but if they really had realized where the country was going to end up now, I sincerely believe that at least a few of them wouldn't even have bothered.
Well, don't you think that they did realize where, at least, where it would try to go? Because that's why you find so much in the Constitution that seem to try to anticipate exactly the kind of things that we want to talk about.
That's true. There's an exceptional amount in the Constitution that has to do with limiting the power of government, certainly not expanding it. I believe that the people who wrote the Constitution were visionary as witnesses to human greed and the exceptional ability of humanity to be cruel to one another, to take advantage of one another. And I believe their intent when they wrote the founding documents was to prevent that type of thing from being particularly easy. And honestly, I think they accomplished that, because here it is, we're a good 200 some years into it, and things have really become dangerously critical now. But it did take some time to get to that, despite the best efforts of some very malicious people who really sought to tear the Constitution down, even from day one.
Yeah, I've said before that upon the unveiling of the Constitution of the United States, and again, this was anticipated, the very next day you had forces that were ready to try to change it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've seen these forces who were attempting to change the Constitution consistent throughout U.S. history. In fact, you see a number of the amendments to the Constitution, most recently that I really found humorous, actually, was the Defense of Marriage Constitution, attempting to make it unconstitutional for homosexuals to get married, as though that is a constitutional issue. These people who want to modify the Constitution for their own, well, in my opinion, petty political necessity is truly shocking. But then there are some people who don't just want to modify the Constitution out of paranoia. They are simply concerned with using it to subjugate their fellow man, or in the case of many things that have been proposed, eliminate those limits on government that are so vital and so important to the Constitution.
Exactly. Either their own political agendas or even their religious beliefs, interestingly enough. We see plenty of that. What we want to discuss to start with, and this is a very hot topic with both Warren and myself, has been for a number of years. And incidentally, Warren and I met each other through an online video game. Okay, we both fly World War II aircraft and became quite good at shooting people down and so forth. And is that not right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We became exceptionally good at it.
And so you can't say that we're not pro-war in our sense.
No. And that has nothing to do with it. Honestly, the stereotype that I've seen that people who are of our political slant are somehow anti-war, anti-American, or anti-patriotic is frankly very depressing to me. And we've seen this as recently as a Time magazine article that I read. But we'll get into that here a little bit more later because I do have some good detail on that to share with people. But really, our origins that really brought us about to this are exceptionally ordinary.
Yes, I would have to agree. And as Warren and I got to know each other, and our squad of guys, if you will, over time, we, you know, struck up some conversations from one time to another and came to realize that we both had very similar viewpoints and concerns regarding 9/11. And as I said, this is a very passionate topic amongst the two of us, and we wanted to devote possibly our first several shows to the topic of 9/11, especially with respect to what did not happen that day as opposed to what we were told that happened that day. Before we get into a bunch of details that chances are you already know, if not, then, well, we like to tease you. So simple as that. We want to start off by basically clarifying the term conspiracy theory. And this is something that you've heard a great deal about. Warren, I know that you're aware that, I mean, the smoke had barely cleared in lower Manhattan before the powers that be were warning us, don't tolerate those. And we're going to play some clips for you to hear for yourself. Don't take our word for it. But is it not true that the term conspiracy theory has become, it's become quite abused in our culture lately?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was almost instant. That and just on the footage of that day, in fact, I was watching some of the original footage the other day. 15 minutes into the initial plane strike, Osama bin Laden's name was being dropped on Fox News. That's 15 minutes.
Right.
And instantly, right after the second aircraft hit, the commentators are commenting on Osama bin Laden. So we have this groundwork for it there. But then that night, the next day, there were a number of people who were already considering, well, there's going to be some conspiracy theorists out there. There's always going to be this type of thing. And we saw this painting of a conspiracy theory as a negative thing practically instantly.
Well, let's take a couple steps back because that's all duly noted. But I want to get this out there from the get-go before we even kick this thing off. A theory, by definition, basically deals with, here's some adjectives, contemplation, speculation, guesses, conjecture, ideas that are pulled out of thin air with nothing whatsoever yet proven to back them up. A theory could be right on the money, and on the other side, a theory could be a complete waste of everybody's time. But a theory is exactly that, am I right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And really, theories are necessary to finding the truth in anything. I mean, you never have any type of scientific law that did not start essentially as a hypothesis first, but you have that that root word of a theory in there, where you theorize that something is true, and then you you set out to prove or disprove it. The scientific method is probably the most valuable tool that humanity has come up with in its search for truth.
I could not agree more. So, in other words, at one time, somebody decided that maybe the world isn't flat after all, because after all, for centuries, if not thousands and thousands of years over the history of mankind, it was assumed the world was flat. In the beginning, it was, however, just a theory until it could be proven. Whereas, on the other hand, someone might theorize that if I drop this pin a certain way, gravity will not bring it to the ground, when in fact gravity is going to bring it down. So a theory can be proven correct, but it can also be proven incorrect.
Oh, exactly, exactly. And just to return to the flat Earth analogy, all the available evidence of the time suggested that the Earth was flat. Every observable thing appeared to be flat. And there were plenty of not only scientists who believed this and taught it and then manipulated their own findings in order to fit the theory that the Earth was flat, but there were religions based around it. There were all these metaphysical reasonings for it. People believed in it very, very thoroughly. And then with the theory that the Earth was in fact round, it became this wild, crazy idea until, of course, there was evidence to back it up.
So let's take a look at the curiosity surrounding not only the current president, but the one before, who was in office at the time of 9/11, obviously, but also the one before that, that have all stated, when either having been confronted publicly about the questions surrounding 9/11, or in the days following 9/11, as part of his job to dispel the notion that anybody might ever question the conspiracy, the actual conspiracy surrounding 9/11. I want to play a few sound bites here to illustrate exactly what we're talking about, because it's not like, take Bigfoot for example. You don't have a president going on national television or radio or any other aspect of media to denounce those who believe in Bigfoot or earthquakes or the Loch Ness Monster or whether or not we sent a rocket to the moon. And why is that? Because it's not important. It's just not enough people to matter. I mean, is that not right?
Oh, exactly. You don't see large media outlets or governmental agencies putting out reports defending the moon landing. You simply don't. I mean, when NASA is questioned about this, their response is, oh, well, that's silly, and they just move on. But they don't have a press release about it. They don't have a spokesman out there specifically to handle this type of thing like we see with several governmental agencies.
That's exactly right. And it seems very, like I said, I keep using the term curious, that all of a sudden when we're talking about 9/11, all of a sudden then we can't have any dissension whatsoever. And it's highly unusual that all of a sudden there would be this push to maintain order, if you will. So we're about to hear from President Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and the current President and Commander-in-Chief, Barack Obama, all in order. And here's what they have to say collectively on those who would dare question the events of September 11th, 2001.
An inside job? How dare you? How dare you?
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves.
I'm aware that there's still some who would question or even justify the offense of 9/11. But let us be clear. Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people on that day. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with.
And deal with those facts we will, Mr. President. Thank you very much. The last three presidents all steadfastly telling you are not to question the events of 9/11, which, as we've been saying, is a very curious phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely. And in and of itself is a very conspicuous phenomenon. You never see this type of attention to any other so-called conspiracy theory at such a high level of government. I mean, here it is, we have presidents themselves continually commenting on it any time that it's brought up. And that's not even counting the numerous lower-level officials who comment on it on a relatively consistent basis anytime it is brought up by concerned citizens.
Yeah, this is members of both houses of Congress. This is governors. I can think of one mayor for sure, whose name I don't think I need to mention, right?
One particular one, yes.
Let's talk about the phrase, what is a truther? What exactly? What do you make of that?
Well, I do want to mention a article I read recently, and I was in Time magazine, about Glenn Beck, who at some point I'm sure we'll dedicate some time to. But throughout the course of the article, they had mentioned right-wing birthers and left-wing truthers. And they sort of just mentioned those one after the other and moved on in the article. And so we've seen this term birther recently that has emerged, kind of a bastardization of the term truther. But truther has become almost a slur, if you will, when it comes to people who are investigative into the events of 9/11. Now, a true truther, not to mince words there, is really somebody who's concerned with finding out the truth of what is perhaps the most important event in recent history. This is more important than, arguably, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Berlin Wall, the first World Trade Center bombing, the Oklahoma City bombing, any other major event that we've experienced. 9/11 is head and shoulders above that. And I believe a true truther is somebody who's simply looking to find out what is behind it.
Which would make those who believe the official story liars?
Well, that's my favorite way of putting it.
That's why I stole it.
If those of us who are seeking the truth are truthers, I have no problem referring to those who would hold up a lie as liars. They don't obviously see it that way, but this term truther isn't something to be worried about. There are polls that have shown that 70% of Americans believe that there was more to 9/11 than we know. Now, whether you believe in a conspiracy theory or not, the very act of questioning the official story means that you're looking for the truth behind that story. So I would argue that 70% of Americans are truthers, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, it all depends on what level of truth they're actually seeking, because I believe John Farmer was the author of the 9/11 Commission Report. Well, he's got a new book out, and I forget the title. We'll hit on that later, perhaps. But, you know, it's not a mystery or a misconception that the 9/11 Commission is essentially a fraud.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, Senator Max Cleland, who I have the highest respect for, actually withdrew from the panel because of his ethical questions over how accurate the panel would be allowed to be, because there was plenty of evidence that was being obscured, even from those whom we charged with investigating this event. Now, on the subject of an investigation, if I may diverge here for just a moment, people don't realize there has never been a criminal investigation into the events of 9/11.
Right.
We were told what happened. We all of us witnessed what happened. And essentially the government for a good 440 days said, well, why bother even investigating? We all saw it on TV. But even when we did do the 9/11 Commission report, that was an investigation. The Congress is not an investigative arm of the government, as much as it would like to be, as much as they pretend they are when it comes to baseball steroid use. It simply isn't. Now, it does make a good attempt at doing so, but Congress cannot criminally prosecute somebody and cannot do a criminal investigation. And we've never seen a criminal investigation for these 3,000 murders.
That is a fact. I think that's a huge assumption that that many people in this country make, that, you know, in the last few years, last couple of years, I've become a fan of, CSI Las Vegas. I probably hopped onto that one pretty late. And then shows like The First 48 and Forensic Files. There's a lot of forensic stuff on television, obviously. And one of the most basic things that you learn when you're looking at any kind of murder investigation, and I don't care if it's a hooker on the streets of Miami or 3,000 Americans and foreign nationals murdered in Lower Manhattan on September 11, 2001, you always have an investigation. And not only do you always have an investigation, but that's why they call it the first 48. It's a good idea to start it you know, a little bit sooner than the first 440 days.
Oh, immediately, of course. And we've never seen this type of delay in any other major event. Investigations for Pearl Harbor, the JFK assassination, those all took place within, well, at the most 2 weeks of the event itself occurring. I mean, the Pearl Harbor hearings began just days after the event, December 10th, I believe. And so to set a precedent of this 440 days, well, not to set a precedent necessarily, but it is far outside of precedent for this investigation to have taken place a year later and for it not to be a criminal investigation.
When exactly was the Warren Commission?
The Warren Commission was later, but there was an investigation into the accident within, or not the accident, JFK's assassination, within days of the assassination. Obviously, there had to have been because they captured Oswald and were putting out the evidence for that. But whether it was an accurate investigation or not is something else we can get into later. But there was a investigation.
Oh, we'll hit on JFK at some point. I mean, if there is anything besides 9/11 that, like I said, we'll get to that at some point.
One of these shows, I'm certain we will.
Yes, we will. Propaganda is what we're talking about. And the way propaganda is delivered, the way it's utilized, and again, we're not the first two guys or the first one guy. This is not the first show to try to convey this, but it's as simple as if I go back to my kindergarten years, first, second grade. You remember how you used to teacher would occasionally sit the class in a semicircle, and she would slip a piece of paper to a child at one end of the circle, right side or left side, either one. And on the piece of paper, it said, "The dog ran up the hill." And by the time that piece of paper was whispered, the contents was whispered from one student to the other, by the time it got to the other side of the room, it was, you know, "When the hell is recess?" You know, it had nothing to do with any truth as it started. That's kind of a roundabout analogy, but propaganda is something that's been utilized by every government I've ever heard of. And so the idea that it just can't happen here is ludicrous. It's absolutely insane.
Absolutely. Well, and propaganda has been used on the American populace on a frequent basis. I mean, this is not a abnormal thing. I mean, for example, and one of my favorite examples is the Gulf of Tonkin incident that spurred us into Vietnam. One of the most fantastical stories that never happened. So we have these events that are put out there. We'll get into the Northwoods document here eventually. That's a very compelling piece. I actually read through the entire thing a few days ago, despite being dramatically boring governmental legalese. It is a shocking document of political and public manipulation by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the country. And I do honestly have to respect JFK for firing the individual who proposed that idea. But we look at propaganda, and propaganda is a very, very popular tool. And it's one that the American government has not left behind.
Not at all. in no way. And of course, you mentioned Kennedy wanting to go back to the gold standard. He did not want to accelerate Vietnam. He fired so-and-so for the Northwoods document, and we see where it got him. So, moving right along, debunkers. What do you think of the debunkers?
Debunkers are, to be completely honest with you, debunkers are some of my favorite people. And I'm not saying that tongue-in-cheek. I'm not saying that in order to, in any way, make fun of them. Because debunkers are people who have faith. Debunkers are people who believe the official story. They believe that those who would question the official story are not only wrong, but in some cases are unpatriotic or criminally wrong in some interesting ways. But debunkers themselves are a group of people who have faith. And I have to respect people who have faith, even when I think it's incredibly misplaced, as it is in this case. Now, the problem with that, and you run into this when people who have faith are challenged with this amazing thing called evidence, they very rarely are able to answer you with evidence. Because in many cases, faith is not based on evidence. Faith is based upon faith, which is not a particularly sound foundation. And so,
could it be that it's also a theory?
Well, the very act of believing in the official story, as far as I'm concerned, is a theory. I mean, the official story is a conspiracy theory. It was a conspiracy by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the hijackers. They were the conspirators, and they were theorized to have pulled off this attack. Now, I don't personally happen to believe that, but these people who do, when you present them alternative theories or evidence that challenges their theory, you'll find that they very quickly change tactics on you. They no longer discuss evidence. They no longer want to present statistics or recognize the evidence that you presented to them. And you have noticed this as well. They fall to ad hominem attacks. They start attacking you personally. They start questioning your patriotism. They start questioning your sanity in many cases. You and I have both recently been the recipients of the tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist accusation. And I don't know about you. I don't even have tinfoil. I wear an aluminum foil hat because tin is far too difficult to find anymore.
Yeah. Well, what I find remarkable is that, like you said, the name calling, the personal attacks. I've had a lot of discussions about this topic since I kind of woke up, and we're going to discuss here in a few minutes what led each of us to discover that there were problems, as well as how we felt about it on that day. But the number one answer, I would say, the number one answer easily that I've been given to refute any of the evidence that you just mentioned, and let me add, there is a plethora of evidence pointing not only to a conspiracy but a massive cover-up of unprecedented proportions. But the number one answer I always get is, the government wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that. Oh, well, case closed, right?
They
wouldn't do that. And then you get into you get into more theoretical answers, such as, well, I'm so sure that so many thousands of people that would have been necessary to rig the buildings to blow up or whatnot, there's just no way that could possibly happen. It's all based on, as you said, faith, and most of it assumption. And if that doesn't work, the further into a hole they dig themselves into, the more irritated they become. And I mean, nobody likes to lose an argument, but you know, our goal in this endeavor that that we're pursuing here on Jackalope 105 FM is to stop the arguing. Let's find our common ground and let's just look at the facts.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I do want to, I suppose, clarify is, when I want to discuss this with somebody, I don't want to discuss speculation on what I believe happened. That has very little to do with, honestly, what I believe happened probably has very little to do with the reality of what actually happened. But I can focus on the evidence for what did not happen. And again, as we progress here, we're going to be demonstrating some of that evidence. I do get the argument a lot that the government would not do it, despite the fact that we've seen this government attack its own citizens before, and we'll be presenting evidence for that, besides the plans to attack its own citizens, but besides, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we were told that we were under attack by a foreign nationality. And so the government has done things that are strikingly similar before, just not on this scale, and it is shockingly scaled up. I do admit that.
Well, one of the biggest concerns is, in less than 24 hours, the Patriot Act comes out. We haven't had an investigation yet. We have no idea, literally. We know that the story started unfolding, as you mentioned earlier in the show, some 15 minutes or 20 minutes or something before here comes Bin Laden's name, and nobody knew who he was. I know that many people suspected that it was terrorism. You know, obviously, once the second plane hits, it's pretty clear it's not just a bad pilot that we're talking about. It's a strange state of affairs. It really is. When the first thing they did was attack our civil rights, most of Congress didn't even bother reading it. And again, there's so much more to this story. But before we go too far into the actual evidence, we wanted to spend the last portion of the show discussing each of our experiences on 9/11. Because I think you'll also find that we were like anybody else. The anger, the shock, the surprise, the suspicions, and the outright failure on my part anyway to question anything. You just weren't in the mood to question anything. You know, the television was very powerful, and I saw very little of it that day. Why don't you lead off, Warren? What do you recall?
Oh, absolutely. For me, I was working overnight at the time. I was working at an office supply store. It was an absolute dead-end job. And every time you hear somebody talk about 9/11, you hear them say, well, nobody expected 9/11 to change anything. You know, that 9/11 was just like every other day. For me, 9/11 was going to change everything. For me, I had a job interview that day, and it was going to be a big opportunity for me. I was going to be able to park myself in a nice comfy cubicle and read memos and live out the office space dream, which when you're working retail is actually not that bad a prospect. And so I expected that. And so I had worked September 10th overnight. September 11th in the morning, I remember getting ready. I had a snazzy purple shirt I was pulling on with a fantastically matching tie, which does not look nearly as gay as it sounds, I promise you. And I was going to go in. And so I hopped online to check my email right before I was leaving. And I see this headline that a plane has struck the World Trade Center. And needless to say, immediately, I flipped the TV on. And from then on, I was watching and just watching all day long. I canceled the interview. And I sat in front of the TV and I just flipped channels practically all day long. Now, I did work overnight, so eventually I had to pass out and take some sleep. I woke up around the time that Building 7 fell. And at the time, this is how incredibly uneducated I was as far as the World Trade Center. I woke up and the reporter said that World Trade Center Building number 7 had fallen. And I thought that meant that 7 buildings had collapsed. Okay, because to me, I thought there were only two World Trade Center buildings. I thought there was one tower and then the other tower, and then you moved on, right? No, right. I didn't know it was all complex. So that's how uneducated I was about this, just right off the bat. But I remember that collapse, and I didn't think anything of it. I moved on. I thought, wow, this is just a really, really bad day. And I went to work that night, and I didn't do anything at work. I worked with this gentleman who was this 18-year-old kid from Colorado, heavily tattooed, pierced, you know, loved heavy metal music, that kind of thing. Not the most sophisticated of guys, but he and I had exactly the same sentiments that day. We were both incredibly pissed off. We were mad that we, as Americans, had been attacked. And we spent that whole night sitting in front of CBS. It was CBS Headline News had was on the radio. They were simulcasting on the radio. It was on TV. And we just sat there looking at each other. And I remember he didn't express himself in a particularly articulate way. His comment on this was, "Those fuckers." And my comment to that was, "Yeah." And then we'd watch a little bit more coverage, and I was so pissed off. And I remember after a few minutes, I just went, "Those fuckers." And he went, "Yeah." And that was the extent of our conversation throughout the whole course of the evening. It didn't get any more elevated than that, as much as I wish it had. Now, that's what I experienced was anger. It wasn't a sense of vulnerability, because where I lived at the time wasn't way up on the terrorist attack list, I promise you. But it was this sense of anger, it was a sense of injustice at watching what people had done to my country. And so for me, I was a witness to what happened. I certainly didn't participate in it. I didn't know anybody who lived in New York. I still don't know anybody who lives in New York. But it was this sense of Americanism that was very important to me, and that was endangered by what I saw on TV. And I'll let you go ahead and tell what happened to you on that day before you really get into the after effects of this.
Well, I was, and you were in KC, I take it, correct?
I was.
Okay. Well, I was in Fresno. At the time, I was still in the radio industry, working at a Hot AC in Fresno, California. I worked middays. I went on the air at 10 o'clock, actually, did your all-request lunch hour, that kind of thing. A lot of Sheryl Crow and some 80s music and Maroon 5, stuff like that. Really cool job. I was really into it. And fact is, I was not really into mornings at all. And so even though I only had to be, I didn't have to be on the air till 10 o'clock, that was still plenty morning enough for me, just being the night owl that I am. And I'd had company the night before. I had a quote-unquote guest, if you will, over till probably 3:30 to 4 a.m., right around there. I had a bit to drink. It was a real boring Monday night on the evening before. Not a lot going on, and took a young lady home to hang out for a while, and she actually left. She didn't stay over the whole night. But either way, I was still pretty late getting to sleep, and it wasn't unheard of for me to actually be late, even though 10 o'clock sometimes came really, really early, or actually 8:30, 8:45 to hop in the shower and get ready to go in. And that morning, the phone rang at my apartment, I want to say around 7:05 to 7:10. Looking back, that's about 10:10 in New York. And so things were starting to unfold, and I'm sure the calls were starting to trickle in. And I remember it was funny that the phone was ringing, and I just knew that the morning show was calling me because I was late. And so I remember, you know how you kind of wake up late and your whole day is off, right? You just spend the rest.
Every day, single day, I wake up and I'm, oh my God, I'm late.
Yeah, and so it was that unpleasant, really hungover, gosh, dang it, I overslept. And I remember opening my eyes when I realized the phone is ringing, get up, dug my face out from under the pillow and looked, and my alarm was, it was early. And it occurred to me, I woke up quickly, I thought I was late, oh my God. And I realized it was so early, so I picked up the phone because I was briefly concerned. And it was actually the female co-host on our morning show calling me to come up and help. Because New York is having a problem. World Trade Center is being bombed. And I'm like, bombed? And I mean, I'm just waking up. I'm hungover, and I'm really not in the mood for any jokes or anything like that, which I remember thinking for a split second, this is not funny. Because the morning show would do bits and stuff, and you never really knew who they were going to call or what kind of pranks they would do. And so I asked for clarification on this. What do you mean being bombed? And my next thought is, how does that affect me in Fresno, or you, or anybody else? And she just stressed that we may be under attack, the country is threatened right now. And I could tell that I was at the time very good friends with her, and I knew that there was a level of seriousness. And then I was thinking back to the Trade Center bombing in 1993, and so I was like, okay, yeah, oh well, whatever. I was like, you sure you can't handle this? And the fact is, this was a cluster of radio stations in one building, as we had in the industry at that time, and no one knew how to do anything with news. It was all music stations, and we had our station, a rock station, a jazz station, oldies, rap, a couple others, and we didn't have a news station. So there was, we didn't have reporters, really. And I had been a program director for a news station in San Luis Obispo, California. I had handled, little minute 2-minute newscasts for music radio as well. So I guess I gotta go. Hung up the phone, got up, threw some shorts and some flip-flops on. I mean, I had sandals or whatever, a t-shirt, just trying to get out the door. And I do recall going into the living room and turning on the television. And it was so, it was strange, I guess, because I had been to Manhattan for the first and only time my whole life about 3 weeks before. I had really been enamored with the World Trade Centers, studying the one with the tower on top and, you know, the other one that didn't have one. And I've always been fascinated by big things, I guess, you know, tall buildings, giant thunderheads, whatever. And the first image I see on television is this smoke coming out from what, you know, ended up, you know, World Trade Center number one. I honestly can't quite decide if both towers had been hit or not, because I was just so in a fog, and I didn't even understand that airplanes had been involved. I remember thinking, this is a fact, I remember thinking, why would they bomb it so high up? But it looked awfully serious. So off I go to work. I woke my brother up and told him, you know, get up, you may have to relieve me at 10, because it was apparent that it was, you know, the news bulletins were on TV, and not that the side of the Trade Center itself wasn't bad enough, but you had the scroll bars at the bottom and the text, and so you knew that there was apparently a coordinated terrorist attack. So off to work I went to deal with that, and that's really the last television that I really got to see on that day up until, you know, much later that afternoon. I hadn't slept a lot, didn't feel like I was going to have much show that day, and I remember getting in, and the morning show was approaching the halfway point, and I go right to the AP, to the Associated Press Wire Service, and I worked Oklahoma City bombing, as a matter of fact, when I was younger in the business at a Dallas radio station. And I never thought that I would ever see a day where there were so many news bulletins than in 1995, I believe it was, the Oklahoma City bombing. And 9/11 surpassed that by quite a bit. I couldn't keep up with it at all. Nobody could read everything that was coming through. And of course, a lot of it was recycled. But by the time my show came around, we had already joined the area news station for Fresno. We weren't doing music or commercials. There's no shows. It was considered a national emergency. And we adapted to that protocol with the EAS alert system. And we literally sat there listening. Just an amazing story. It's funny because I recall about 20 minutes, maybe 10, 15 minutes before our program director decided maybe it's time to go ahead and go back to music now. It was about 2:15 or 2:20 or so in the afternoon, so my whole shift was 10 to 3. I really didn't do anything but pass out news, and as things began to calm down by about 12 o'clock California time, there's no more airplanes in the air at that point, and it's just a matter of sitting there and just trying to read some and catch up on what's going on. And just an incredible day. And you know, we want to hit on World Trade Center 7 because it's strange, because you know, you had mentioned that you didn't know yourself that there was multiple buildings in the complex, and I didn't either, having been to Manhattan. I had no idea that there were that many, but I remember hearing about another building has collapsed. This was just a few minutes before we went back to format, and it just seemed like, well, I guess so. You know, because by then it seems like perhaps the program director of the jazz station had a small portable TV, and so I had seen, you know, quick footage of the towers collapsing, and just the rest of it was just mostly listening to all of this information that was going on that day. And I didn't question that at all, and frankly never heard anything about it ever again. And went back to format, and you know, my brother, ironically, of course, I don't know if there's irony in this, but we both worked on the air. He worked afternoons, and so he came on at 3. I went home, was starving at the time, Didn't eat breakfast, which wasn't unusual, but I had a much earlier start to the day than usual, and got some food, went home. I remember crashing for 2 or 3 hours, well, probably more like 4 or 5 hours, actually, and by the time I woke up that night, my brother was home, and then it was, I guess, what everybody else felt. You were just completely drained, heavy-hearted isn't even the word, knowing what had happened, and just a really rotten feeling about everything, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, and I believe that was a universal feeling among those of us who saw it. I do know some people, very rarely, who were not even aware of the event that day. They were apparently living under a rock or a bridge or some other heavy object that prevented them from hearing about the news. But the rest of us, we all shared in that same sensation on that day. It was exhaustion. It was anger. It was sadness. It was frustration. We all saw the events of the day and were helpless to do anything about it. The people who were there, the rescue workers, the firefighters, the police officers, the paramedics, who were present on that day, were powerless to do anything about it. And the 300-plus first responders who lost their lives in that event couldn't have done anything about it, and yet they died in an attempt to save people, which is a level of bravery that I hate to say this, but I cannot match. I'm not one of those people. I'm not a first responder. I'm not a firefighter. I'm not going to be running into a building that's just had a plane hit it and is on fire. And so I can't underline enough how emotionally touched I was on that day.
Well, you've mentioned before that you kind of became a fan of 9/11, and I shared a very similar fascination. I remember for several days, looking at everything I could on the web, looking at the photos, looking at any replays of video, just being completely engulfed by this event. You know, I remember the Challenger blowing up. I watched that live, actually. Skipped school that day, back in 1986. I was in eighth grade, I guess. And very similar feeling that night after the surprise of the event. And at some point, you start to really absorb the fatalities. The people jumping, I think, was probably the most horrific aspect of the whole thing. That I came across. I mean, it was bad enough that you knew that these passengers on airplanes were hijacked against their will, flown into buildings, but the people jumping, I mean, at least the people in the airplanes were killed instantly, you know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I don't, I've used the term fan of 9/11, and I don't particularly like that term, because it makes one believe that I think it's great that 9/11 happened, that type of thing. But I did go out and I bought the Nine Day Brothers film immediately after it came out. I mean, the moment it came out, I had a copy of it. And I watched it repeatedly because it was such an emotionally gripping story. And my interest in 9/11 came from not only scenes from that film, but scenes from the day, the sounds of the day. And there's one in particular I want to play here, and I want you to listen to this, and I just want you to listen to it, and I will tell you what it is afterward. But listen to this here. And that noise is the culmination of approximately a 9-second hell that nobody should have to live through. That's what it sounds like when somebody landed at the base of the World Trade Center after being forced to make the decision to jump from one of the upper floors. It's one of the most disturbing noises that I can identify. And frankly, that decision to jump or not jump really is a decision between jumping and dying, or staying where you are and dying. Is one of the things that I can't even imagine, but it's one of the things that has motivated me to get involved in 9/11 even before I began to believe there was anything unusual about it. The mere injustice of it is what drove me to even become interested in this in the first place.
Yeah, it is a, you mentioned that Not A Brothers film, and a friend of mine up in Fresno by the name of Rafi, he's a photographer, really cool guy. He called me up one night. I was just hanging out at my place, and he brought that, I believe it was either the film you're talking about, or it was, I believe it was America Rebuilds, a CNN documentary. But either way, it contained that footage of what you're talking about. And as we were watching, in that segment of the film, they're in the lobby of the World Trade Center, a bunch of firemen, and they're, you know, making their plans to go up and figuring out what they can do about this. And I heard the first crash, exactly what we heard a couple minutes ago. The first crash, heard it again and again, and I finally looked over at Rafi, and he was looking at me already. And I know he was waiting for me to, he was waiting for it to dawn on me that that noise has to be something falling and hitting the ground with an awful lot of force. It wasn't bombs. It was loud crashes. And no sooner did I, you know, make mutual eye contact with them, I was suspect that that's what it was. I said, is that bodies? And he just nodded his head. And, you know, he, like myself and everybody else I knew at the time, was similarly amazed and horrified at what happened.
Well, those events punctuate the horror of the day. Obviously, no aspect of 9/11 was in any way pleasant or even reasonable. But it was an absolutely all-around awful, awful situation for everybody who was involved. But again, those are punctuations. Those are the best examples of horror on that day that I can imagine. And so that is what has motivated me to be involved in researching 9/11 and looking into it, and what really led me into the door of what we see with the truth movement. A number of so-called truthers, like we presented before, are merely people who believe that we're not fully aware of the extent of the events of that day. And that's where I was for quite some time.
And isn't it compelling that not only could you live through that day and in the days that followed, and you absorb everything that we did, and could you ever imagine at that point that this whole event could become that much worse than it already was?
No, not even remotely. Because as bad as it was, on September 12th, September 11th was already history. It was that bad thing that happened the day before. And in my mentality, and I know in the mentality of many Americans, we were already beginning that process of healing and of moving on. And I believe that's part of the resistance we find as a truth movement, is people don't want to reopen that wound. And I fully understand that, because it is a very raw wound. Even now, 8 years later, it is not something to be idly spoken of. And yet, on September 12th, it was already a piece of history. It was still very raw history, but it was still history. And so that's where we find ourselves not being able to comprehend that anything worse could come out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on next week's show, we're going to kind of take a tour through the evolution of doubt, if you will. What exactly took us from people just like our neighbors, our coworkers, our friends, our family? What took Warren and myself from who we were that day and who we became later on? Because we didn't change. I didn't change. you know, you didn't change. Our awareness and our education on the event, however, did change, and I think that's the main difference.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a step-by-step process. Obviously, it wasn't an overnight decision for me to go from the believing side in the original story to become, well, to become a truther after having been a liar for so long, to resurrect that term. It was not an overnight decision. It was not an easy decision. The first time that I told somebody that I believed the 9/11 story was wrong, I felt very awkward doing so. And yet we're going to take you step by step through that process on next week's show. And perhaps you've already taken some of those steps. Perhaps you want to take some of those steps. We will be presenting resources to you. We will be presenting the things that we saw that we thought were valid. If you believe those things are valid too, then that's great. That's great. We want to open people's eyes to this. If you believe those things are not valid, well, obviously there are ways to contact us here at the show. You can always email us. RepublicTheory@AOL.com is probably the fastest way to get a comment to us. We do read and on rare occasion even respond to comments.
Well, you read. I'm still learning how myself.
Well, you do a lot of the do a lot more responses than I do. I've seen your YouTube channel.
Yeah, right. Well, I do believe that is a wrap, and we look forward to visiting with you next week right here, Jackalope 105 FM. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and once again, we'll be discussing the evolution of doubt into the official story of 9/11. And anything in closing, Mr. Warren Dyson?
No, I just hope everybody has a safe week, and I look forward to being able to speak with everybody else next week.
Sounds like a plan. For Warren Dyson, I am Dallas Andrews, and this is Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM. Thanks for tuning in.